David A. Price presents...
Hello, folks, and welcome to Marvel Noise, episode 368. I'm your host, Steve Raker, stationed down in the Bronze Age vault that is the comic book bunker. On this episode, for the first almost hour, Whirlwind X Kevin and I are going to share some recent reads, then Andrew will join in, and we'll get to our fourth installment covering the original Bronze Age series of Nova, The Human Rocket, with issues 21 to 25. Of 25. Dun dun dun. Marvel Noise is the semi-monthly podcast proudly sponsored by Nobody. You can find, listen to, stream, and download episodes past and present over on marvelnoise.com. There's a handy little drop-down menu on the right-hand side to bring up past months and years for archived episodes, and they're all cleaned up now, too, so when you go back to past months, you'll just see episodes instead of all the old solicitations and stuff. Looks great. Get new episode announcements, see images and cover galleries on our Facebook and Twitter pages, and find other fine podcasts from our benevolent host, the Deliberate Noise Network, including Indie Comic Book Noise, our sister show where we talk about indie comics. Well, mostly Andrew, Kevin, and Phil, but I get on there every few episodes or so. Item: Comic-Cons are back. The Baltimore Comic-Con is back. A longtime friend of this podcast, the Baltimore Comic-Con is a comic-centered show full of fantastic guests and artists. It's a giant artist's alley, true believers, and it's back at the Baltimore Convention Center in the Inner Harbor Tourist Trap Zone for 2021. October 22, 23, and 24 are the dates. See the already substantial guest list and get tickets and other info at BaltimoreComicCon.com. See you in Baltimore. Can't wait. Avengers Assemble! Hey, what's new in Baltimore? Hey. So, what you been reading, Kevin?
Boy. How was my stack of books, Steve?
Somebody's been busy.
I mean, I usually bring one or two issues, right? I mean, like, I'm not the guy to be like, well, I just read a 40-issue run. Like, I would love to be the guy to just, like, 1 week just plow through something.
That sounded like a Foot Locker full of issues.
I mean, I'm not saying this is a 40-issue run, but I've been, like, so many, like, new number ones or whatever I'm usually covering, and I'm like, oh, what are we gonna talk about this time? Little did I realize that I had, like, 8 issues of Strange Academy read, that whole Shang-Chi miniseries read, so I'm like, why don't I talk about some of this stuff?
Those are blind spots for me, both of them, so I'm psyched for you to tell me about them.
Well, that's the other thing, too. Like, we talk about Guardians of the Galaxy, and I'm like, am I going to talk about the latest issue again? I mean, like, something's good, but generally, I think people know that some of these books are... Or we talk about these books, so, I mean...
Don't you get trapped with that, though? Don't you get stuck with that, though, sometimes, Kevin, where it's like you got to keep reading different stuff to be able to, like, talk about it with me, but... You know, it's like, but you want to read the book that you still like, but that you've talked about a lot already.
Yeah, I know.
And the issues are piling up. It's like, wait a minute, I got these 4 series that I'm way behind on, but I've already talked about them, so I got to find something else.
Well, the weird thing about Strange Academy is I'm like, I enjoyed the first issue enough with, Scotty Young and Roberto Ramos. And then I just kept on ordering, like, an issue at a time. And then I'm like, I'm sure this book is still good or whatever. But I'm like, it's not It's weird, right? Because I like have a whole system. Like sometimes I'll just be like sight unseen, or like the creative team is good enough. I'm like, just add that. Like if this is a disaster after 6 months, I'll just cut it loose or whatever.
Does it scratch the same kind of itch that like Wolverine and the X-Men used to scratch, or does it just make you wish for that book?
It's funny that if I was going to use a comparison, like I would say those other school kids academy types of books, and then I'm like I realize like kids can get annoying, like there's too much drama or like just something, or they get into some bullying plots, and I'm like I don't really need this. But then I look at what I've read, like I've read like Avengers Academy, like Gotham Academy, and like all these things, and I'm like, why would I be resistant to this idea? Like I've read a lot of these Wolverine and the X-Men,
right?
Like, I obviously like these types of books.
You can't be chased away by the "I've seen this before," because we've read a lot of comics for a lot of years, you know.
And some of these ideas it was in Harry Potter or whatever. Like there's a long legacy of a certain ideal, and there's a reason why there's a long legacy of these things. They work. They're good if you do them properly. So yeah, finally I have progressed to the, okay, I'm just going to stop ordering issue at a time and just go all in. Like, I mean, what's the worst that can happen? It'll get canceled at issue 12? Which, probably not where it's going. Like, I think it had a reasonable amount of buzz when it first came out, and I think people are still reading it, but I'm not. It's not a book I hear about all the time either, and it's not something we discuss all the time either, so.
I remember when subscriptions by mail were more of a thing, like in the 70s and 80s, and when a title got canceled, they would send you a thing like, oh, yay, we're sorry that the book is canceled, but now you can apply the rest of your subscription to any one of these fine titles and and switch over for your last five or your last whatever.
But the cast, I think, is pretty solid for this. Like, you have, I'm going to probably say that Doyle Dormammu is right up there. I mean, that was pretty much probably a given from the beginning. Like, I think sometimes I cover books and I'm like, oh, this is the greatest thing ever. And I feel like this isn't the greatest thing ever, but it's also, I'm not going to say the worst thing ever, but it's enjoyable. It's an interesting book. I obviously enough to get me over the hump there and add it to the ongoing thing. Like, it's a good book.
There's always a threat from within, as well as, you know, the bad guy of the month in these type of academy teen type of books, because you're not dealing with all established characters, so someone can be the sour apple. How is that part of the story, if it exists? Or you could help put my foot in my mouth and say, no, there's nothing like that. But if there is something like that, is that part of the story intriguing, or is it pretty vanilla?
There's some stuff here that you wonder if it's just like more traditional, and then you're like, is that just a one-off? Like, if they have the fortune teller, like, using more fortune teller stuff, I'm like, why would the characters believe this fortune teller? But then it's the Marvel Universe. So something happens with Doyle, and he's like, oh, no, I'm going to destroy the world or whatever.
All right.
And then they start getting into the, you know, like TV shows would be like, well, we can only show people that are important or that are the chosen one or something.
Sure.
Because everyone else would be boring.
Yeah.
So you sort of have some kind of stuff going on like that. But then I always ask that question about, like, when the character points out, like, oh, that's a stupid plot point or something. But he sort of acknowledges after there's this altercation in the book. That he is part of a cliche plot point type of thing, and these type of things are like, oh, I'm going to destroy the world or whatever.
Forgive me, but it sounds a little bit Kid Apocalypse-y.
I mean, yeah, but the thing is, like, with Kid Apocalypse, you're like, yeah, he's more subdued than his father, but I kind of feel like he came from a bad situation, and they're like, oh, let's see if he turns out differently.
And to be fair, Kevin, that book was probably like more than 10 years ago, so it's okay, yeah, if there's things that are reminiscent of it.
But I feel like there's, like, other than, like, his father being Dormammu and everything, like, I don't think he's rather ever been shown that he has the same evilness. Mm-hmm. Like he's... there's certain things in here, like, I mean, maybe he'll get to that point.
Of course he will.
Yeah, I mean... But it seemed more like just kids goofing around and everything, like, and they have, like, all the different classes like they go to, all the crazy teachers, and it just it doesn't seem too much.
Well, from Scotty Young having worked on the young X-Men when they were like the X-Men school book at the time, he probably came up with a lot of ideas that he either didn't pass on or didn't get used that he has thought about and or would have done differently when they were done or plays. You know what I mean? He probably has a lot of this stuff floating around in his head to use. So that's cool.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, they run across some bad dudes either when they're just goofing around and going to different dimensions or planets or whatever. And then they run into these like tree folk, like the Hollow. And like there is the remember in Doctor Strange there was a whole black and white world that they would go to with the color, so they sort of touch on that. And then the cost of magic, like there's so much magic going on here, and then someone kind of knows, like, I don't know if it's more than they should, but it's like, well, how are you paying for this type of thing?
No, we're not gonna try, like, to oh, we're not going to try to pin down and understand how magic works in the Marvel Universe again, are we?
Well, I don't think so. But, like, and then they're like, oh, we'll get to that type of thing. So that's, I mean, I don't know if you would say that's intriguing. I just took it as, oh, well, like, at least you acknowledge the type of thing. But there is something going on with that. And I guess since they're kids, they kind of think they're invincible because, like, one of them is, like, they think the cost takes care of everything. Like, I guess maybe they extrapolate on that point. Like, we're invincible because we can just do magic, whatever. But then they have this run-in with these tree magic folk dudes. And things get a little heated there.
The Ents are pissed.
Yeah. So you have all this school stuff, but then it starts, like, going further outward. Like, you have, you remember the guy, the, like, cat-like appearance, but he's, like, humanoid. Why am I blanking on that guy's name now?
The one that fought Iron Fist, or the one who fought
Hogarth? He shows up, and then they also go to another planet with like Groot, Rocket Raccoon, because of course there's magic in other places, and they even have Dead Girl show up as sort of like a psychiatrist. So they're expanding their Marvel Universe reach. I mean, it's not a witch hat atelier good, but it's good enough.
Hey, it's comics. It just has to be fun comics, right?
It is.
I read a good one that's, I mean, it's weird how Marvel is, done a lot of. I mean, I guess there's no keeping any inventory stories anymore because there just seems to be these seemingly random one-shots that pop out several times a year that are sometimes oversized, sometimes not. They're just peppered throughout the regular year's publishing schedule.
Yeah.
In spite of the annuals and the regular series.
Yeah, they seem to always have an excuse to, like, it's an anniversary. I always wonder if it's also because, you know, just for practical reasons.
For talent, though, it's not always, you know, B and C creators, which is kind of neat. I mean, maybe it's just that, hey, you want to do a Hulk story? We have a way that we can do a Hulk story and not interrupt the regular Hulk run and everything else. That's what this is. It's a Hulk story. It's Immortal Hulk Threshing Place. And it's a one shot from last year in 2020. 30 pages a story, which is nice. Written by Jeff Lemire, no slouch. With art by Mike Del Mundo, no slouch.
Yeah.
Kevin, this is totally like an episode of the old 70s Hulk TV show. I mean, it's like Bruce is wandering the middle America on the run investigating a missing 9-year-old farm girl. The farm is right next to like a butts a chemical pesticide factory with a chain link fence and everything. The farmer suspects Bruce, who gets locked up and then has to hulk up and do his thing and try to make everything right and fight a big pesticide evolved monster thing before it's all said and done. But then the issue ends with Bruce walking down the highway and you're looking at him and he's walking away. I mean, it's just like the last shot from the old show. It's so funny.
Cue sad piano music.
Yeah, but it was a good, quick little... I'm not sure how it would do on the stopwatch test, Kevin. But it's Del Mundo art, so there's a lot You know, when there's a red wall, it ain't just red, right? So, like, there's a lot to look at, which slows you down.
That's what I was going to say. Like, if you're going to have, like, not much in other regions of your comic, like if there's a pie graph or some kind of thing, or like like a Venn diagram, it's like, yeah, you need more than just a regular artist, right? You mean like Del Mundo is gonna stick your eyeballs to that page.
Yep. This is like the Ariel Olivetti-ish type Del Mundo, where the figures are more solid and defined rather than everything getting crazy, but it's still real nice and the colors are excellent.
That's a way they can put out some extra issues, because Immortal's not expanding outward to a universe crossover or doing any other crazy stuff, really. So you need those like one-shots. I mean, I guess they did some, like, 2 issues a month, but they seem to have pulled back on that and put out more one-shots instead.
Yeah, I think a lot of that double-shipping month stuff got interrupted with a publishing hiatuses.
Yeah, that too. Yeah.
So, tell me about the Shang-Chi book, because he's one of those characters where it's more the creative team than the character for me. And it's more like the take and like what they're going to kind of do with it. I like the old traditional stuff, but I can't say that I'm the biggest fan. Like the stuff that I've liked of his appearances most modern has probably been where he's been involved with some, like, other characters, like ensemble-wise, like team-wise, like when it's been like some of the Heroes for Hire or that kind of a thing, where he's like hanging out with a few other street-level characters.
I was trying to remember the pronunciation for Shang-Chi from that trailer as well. I'm like, maybe we've been saying it wrong all these years. I'm like, who knows? This isn't a Magneto situation.
It's been Shanghai all these years.
Yeah, I feel like I would say that, oh yeah, I love him in those classic, or looking at those classic things, because I'm like, I don't think I've really read any of them, but looking at all that stuff and seeing all those covers, like, it looks great, and that's what I think of when I think of Shang-Chi, but I don't think I've read a lot of appearances that really, like, I would be like a fake fan, I think, if I said I was, which is weird, because I know he like showed Spider-Man how to fight before.
You're just,
and like, maybe showed up in Heroes for Hire or something.
Oh yeah, and Marvel team ups,
yeah.
And
yeah,
you know, he was hanging out with the Avengers for a little while there, and
so this might be the first time I've ever read a lot of consecutive issues with
Shadowland. Kevin, he was probably hanging out with those guys.
Yeah. So this is by Gene Yang, and then I know Philip Tan. But I'm not familiar with Dyke Ruan.
Yes, I am.
What other books?
Dope.
You put you on
that.
The spot.
Yeah, I know him more from seeing his original art on, like, the original art boards that I, or pages on Facebook that I'm part of.
Yeah, because they sort of have different sequences in here, so they have two artists. It works out well. I mean, it's not like Mike DeMundo good or anything. Like, it's not superstar good, but it's pretty good. The main reason I wanted to talk about this was the end. This is one of those things where I think I read the first issue. Foom appears. There's some other interesting stuff. I kind of wondered how much of the movie is in here. Because if they did a movie setup, like, I could see this totally being in the movie, but I don't know if they would. Like, there's certain elements, I don't know if they would go in that direction, but there's a lot of family stuff, which I could totally see being in there. And then they have the, oh, what did they call them? The Five Weapons Society, with, like, a ghostly uncle is hanging around. And then Shang-Chi is, like, Brother Hand. And then they have, like, Brother Saber, Sister Dagger, Sister Hammer, some MI6 agents. A bunch of stuff like that going on in this book. I just let it build up. And now I'm reading this, and I'm like, I feel like it's good, but it never hit that, like, next level. And I wonder if that was all, because this is basically set up. Like, the first issue is coming out soon.
Yeah, I think it just hit this week as we're recording this in May.
What way to date the show? That's because Andrew's not here, I have to say that. So you could read that. I'm sure you could read that first issue, and they'll just fill you in on the pertinent details. But if you need to know what happened, like, if that really intrigues you, like, what is now, like, his Marvel Universe role, these five issues set that all up.
So it's a lead-in.
So that's why I'm hoping that's what brings it up to, like, that other level. This is also not really, like, the Marvel Universe doesn't really intersect with this miniseries. While his ongoing will, I assume it's an ongoing, right? Am I foolish to assume is?
I think they hope it will be. Got a movie coming out, for crying out loud.
That's what I'm thinking.
It's got to at least make it that long.
Because some people play fast and loose with the series thing. Like, when they say Darkhawk is going to get a series, and then I see it's a mini, I'm like, oh, of course it's a mini series. So anyhow, yeah, the thing about this is You're not a big Agents of Atlas guy either.
True.
But the whole thing I loved about when they got into the Agents of Atlas thing is eventually they get inside at the Atlas Corporation. Like, another thing that's been 10 years or whatever, but even Shadowland, like, oh, I'm going to try to control the evil company from the inside type of thing. A riff on that. So in Agents of Atlas, yeah, they take over, like, the Atlas Foundation. And then they're like, oh, we're going to root out all the, like, evil things that has happened while, like, the other person was running it, like, the father or whoever you have as the force there. So, yeah, it basically at the end of the series, Shang-Chi takes over, like, this evil Five Weapons Society.
He's the new Fu Manchu.
Yeah, totally. Except they never say Fu Manchu. They just use the other name for anything. It's like, if you need to refer to someone, he's just used a totally different name. So that's the setup here. I mean, I think it'll flow better in an ongoing.
Yeah.
They do some interesting historical stuff in this series. And there is some, like, good action with some of the vampire zombie legion and all this stuff, so I'm hopeful.
All right.
But this is sort of, like, enough for me for a while, I think. Like, I don't feel any pressing need to get on to the next series.
Wait till the first arc is done, and then you can read it in a chunk.
Yeah, that'll probably be what I do.
I'm finding myself doing that more and more.
It depends what it is. Like, I find part of the thing is dictated by how often we record, too. So it's like, oh, we got to read, like, that Nova series, so then I'm inevitably putting something aside to read whatever is...
To read the good stuff.
Yeah, so, I mean, that plays.
We got more Nova to come, man, I'm telling you. I still want to read the Eric Larson series, the Bennett series, all that.
Ah, oh, so much Nova.
Let's do it.
If we can just grind out that final Nova thing.
We got it.
I just can't believe, like, out of all the series, I'm like, if they would have solicited that omnibus, I would have been like, oh, this is going to be so awesome. I'm so ready. And I would have been so like, oh no, what did I do?
The complete series just isn't complete. Sorry. All right, let's park the Marvel Noise bus, full of merry pranksters, naturally, in the Hyborian Age for a bit, because it's getting full on into, like, summer, spring weather here, and I love reading Conan outside when the sun's shining. And part of the fun of reading Conan and writing Conan, I'd imagine, is, you know, all the different roles he's held, right? It's like Scrooge in the life and times of Scrooge McDuck. Conan's an adventurer, a barbarian, a wanderer.
Have they done that?
A thief, a mercenary, a soldier, a captain, a pirate. Come on. And ultimately, if the Numidian Chronicles are right, he's becomes king.
I need my Scrooge McConan riff right now.
So Robert E. Howard, who wrote the old Conan stories and is Conan's creator, he wrote his Conan stories for the pulps. But before he took his own life, way before his time, he had his sights set on a book deal opportunity that was presented. And he did write one complete full Conan book length novel, although it wasn't published that way and ended up being serialized in the pulps ultimately. But it's called Hour of the Dragon, Kevin, and it later was retitled Conan the Conqueror when it was put out in novel form. So then fast forward, what, like 40 years to the mid-1970s, and Marvel's got those giant-sized books going on, right? And I had some of the giant-sized. I mean, who didn't have some of those books back then? It was a pretty good deal. But I don't really look back at those issues in any kind of real, like, character continuity or scholarly way, because I kind of think of them as the reprint books that they became at the end. But those giant-sized books typically featured, like, an original lead story before the reprinted material. And Conan was selling pretty good. Stan wanted giant-sized Conan. He's like, Conan needs a second book. So Roy Thomas, the writer of Conan for Marvel Comics, saw the opportunity to adapt Robert E. Howard's one Conan novel, Hour of the Dragon, in giant-sized Conan. And it was supposed to be over 6 issues, but it ended up being only over the first 4 in 1974 and 1975, because by issue 5, the giant-sized books were all reprints. So they couldn't finish it there, but later he gets Gil Kane, who had done the art on the initial installments, to do a black-and-white backup for A Savage Sword of Conan in the end of 1975, and then the next year, in 76, devotes an entire issue of Savage Sword of Conan to finish up the novel adaptation with John Buscema and Tony DeZuniga doing the art, because Gil was on to other things and not available then. So it's pretty cool. You get, like, in Giant Size Conan number 1, it's a King Conan story, too. And there hadn't been a King Conan series yet. So you were just getting little tastes of King Conan here or there in Savage Sword or in the annuals, that kind of thing. And in Giant Size 1, which is art by Gil Kane and Tom Sutton, it's like 4 years into Conan's reign, and there's this cabal of conspirators that are against Conan, and they resurrect this ancient sorcerer from Acheron, which is what existed 3,000 years before the Hyborian Age. Then they attack, and Conan gets captured. In Giant Size 2, his troops get defeated, and Conan's chained up, and he gets released by a slave girl named Zenobia, who is just like she's just like really is putting herself at risk for Conan for King Conan to escape. And she says she just like loved him the first time she saw him march through the town square kind of thing on his horse, and he promises to come back for her. He makes his escape, and then in Giant Size 3, he helps this old woman who's in need. These Nemedian soldiers are giving her the business, and she turns out to be like this old witchy woman who helps Conan and nurses him back to health. He returns to Aquilonia and infiltrates his former kingdom, saves a baroness that he knew from being executed, and then has to like escape, and he gets this aid from this group of priests who were part of a religion who wasn't the primary religion in Aquilonia, and they were kind of persecuted. And when King Conan became king, he made sure that they were like protected and not exiled and allowed to practice their religion. And this they thought that was pretty cool, and they turn around and help him make his escape here. And think about this, that this was written back in the 30s originally, so even though that's like a kind of a cliched concept now, it's interesting that those are the kinds of moral dilemmas or so that they were representing in the Hyborian Age. So when he gets this aid from the priest, he also learns of this like heart bauble gem thing that's like the thing that's going to help him defeat the ancient sorcerer. So now he's got the quest for the the bauble, and from here it becomes like a Maltese Falcon thing, where the bauble changes hands a bunch of times and travels all around, and he's hot on the trail, and he has to go this way and that way, and he's chasing it down by horse, by on foot. He gets captured and made to row on a big galleon, and he ends up doing a mutiny and taking back over, and you know, relives his days as Amra, and some of the black slaves who are on the ship rowing also remember him from his days as Amra with Baelit, with the black corsairs, and he, you know, gets a whole band together again, and it's a lot of fun. And that happens in the backup tale that was in Savage Sword of Conan number 8 with Gil Kane art 2. But then the finale that was in Savage Sword of Conan 10 that had art by Big John Buscema with inks by Tony DeZuniga, who Big John liked inking his stuff on Savage Sword in the black and white book. Conan has to infiltrate Stygia, you know, that's where Thoth-Amon is and all the bad sorcerers and the snake people and stuff. And he obtains the bauble and then has to rally to like gather different dispersed troops that might be still loyal to him, and then lead an attack back on the capital and have all of the initial conspirators meet their ends and everything. And in the end, he ransoms the king of Numidia back to, or he says he's going to ransom them back to his country for the price of the one slave girl that he never even noticed enough to even touch or sully, Zenobia, and make good on his promise. And that's where the book and the adaptation ends, which is cool. But the reason why I wanted to talk about this and just reread it is because now there's a nice trade paperback collection that came out last year in 2020 of all of the chapters, finally combining them into one tome. And Kevin, they even colored the Savage Sword of Conan stuff. And it looks good.
Does it match then?
It's a little bit darker. But there were also black and white washes on some of that artwork, though. It looks really good. It looks really good. And then they add in a nice new foreword by Roy Thomas describing the whole history of the project and everything and kind of juggling it. And two annuals of related material. And it makes a really nice trade paperback, Conan Hour of the Dragon. And the two annuals they put in it, annual number 4 from 78, it's Roy and Buscema and Ernie Chan, tells the story that doesn't get told in the book. It's the perfect epilogue. It's Conan making good on his promise and going back to Numidia for Zenobia and, you know, claiming her. But then, of course, you know, he's betrayed and captured and has to fight his way out of there. But it's still really cool. And then Zenobia all along, even when he's, like, taking her at the end, she's like, oh, I'm honored to join your harem. And he's like, no, girl, you're, you know, part of the whole thing of him losing his kingdom at the beginning of the book was that he doesn't have an heir. So the kingdom very quickly was thrown into chaos. And now, you know, that made him think, I need to take a wife. And that's how, the book starts that way with, like, you need an heir kind of thing, and ends with him deciding that he's going to go back and get Zenobia, but it never shows it. So this does, so that's fun. And then she realizes it's to be a queen, not a slave, and it's like, whoa. Then the next year in Conan Annual 5, which rounds out the trade paperback, it's a sequel to that story, and also kind of a follow-up to the Scarlet Citadel King Conan story, because it's got the bad guy from that they told in Savage Sword of Conan 30, I think. That tale's villain is here, and he kidnaps Zenobia on their wedding day and replaces her with a double. And, like, on their wedding night, he goes to kiss Zenobia, and it's, you know, it's like, this haggy witch thing. And so then you get the story. It ends with their wedding day and wedding night. So it's all cool stuff, and it's King Conan stuff, and it set the stage for the King Conan series, because they were in a groove now of telling these King Conan stories, and they were establishing you know, a supporting cast, and now the Queen, and there aren't any stories of him with the Queen after, so let's tell some. It's so good, Kevin.
You know, I was thinking of Scrooge McConan, but the whole time you kept thinking G.I. Joe. I don't know. I'm like, is it G.I. Conan? I'm like, the snake people and the Baroness? I'm like, what is...
You know what else, though, too? This is a, you know, this is a classic tale, so, I mean, you can enjoy the Robert E. Howard prose version, you can enjoy this original adaptation, but when Dark Horse had the property, they also, in 2012 and 13, did a 12-issue adaptation written by Tim Truman with art by Tomas Giorello. Oh, my gosh, the art's amazing, and it's collected in that colossal King Conan oversized omnibus that they put out, Dark Horse put out, of their Dark Horse King Conan stories
that was ridiculously big.
Oh, it's so good. But that's like the ultimate version of this story, really. But this is a classic. And if you've seen if you did, you're probably one of the few who has, but the 1997 Kull the Conqueror movie was also loosely based. They took this plot.
Really?
And replaced King Conan with King Kull. Yeah.
I think that's probably one of the few Conan Dark Horse stories that I haven't read.
It's really good. But this trade paperback is real nice, too. And you know what I'm noticing, Kevin? They're putting really nice back matter, like in the Epic Collections, how they're putting, like, some pages of original art and... you know, if there's like an article from Marvel Age that had some press art or something like that, or some house ads, you know, that kind
of pieces, trading cards.
They're doing that with this, and Dark Horse had originally reprinted all of the Conan the Barbarian series, but they did it with that updated color, which
that's right, yeah.
Sometimes was interesting, but most of the time was a failure. And hey, yeah. So I started buying the new Marvel Conan Epic Collections of Conan the Barbarian. There's two of them out already. It's the first two volumes, and the third one is just got solicited. That'll be out in a few months. And so it's got the regular original flat colors.
They just threw Dark Horses out.
But what I'm so glad, though, Kevin, I'm so glad I did it, because the back matter is, like, substantial. They've got stuff like panels... how, like, Barry Windsor Smith originally drew them before the Comics Code got a hold of them.
Yeah.
And all that. And there's, like, a lot of back matter. It's really, really nice. Marvel Conan trade paperbacks are really nice collections.
That must be the same stuff that was in the hardcovers, right?
I don't know, because I've only gotten the Savage Sword hardcovers. With the Barbarian series, I'm more like, I'll do that in floppy.
Yeah.
I want to be able to bring that to the beach. But with Savage Sword, I have those phone book Dark Horse reprints of Savage Sword that they did that were like the old Marvel Essentials.
Yeah, so I have the first volume of that.
I got like 11 of them or something. So it's like, I'll bring those to the beach. And
It was one of those situations where, like, do you just keep on ordering? It's like you're not reading, but you're keep on... And it's. Sometimes it's just, you just gotta, like, you order so much stuff, sometimes you just gotta be like, okay, like, ease off a little bit on some of these things.
Savage Sword is one of those series, though, where, like, I have almost all of the issues, and I really read them and enjoyed them, especially those first 60 or so. And, you know, they're old. Often read black and white magazines from the 70s. So yeah. When there was the idea of having even a black and white newsprinty phone book type collection of them, I jumped at the opportunity, and then obviously to have the hardcovers even more so.
Yeah, I only ever had a few of the magazines. I just still remember that time I was in a used bookstore, and like, you're looking for the comics, and then, like, sort of on the floor is, like, a whole long box of the magazines. Like, someone must have just brought and, like, dumped them there.
Yeah.
And then I'm like, oh, I don't know if I want to go through that. But I also don't know how much they would have been. So, like, maybe it isn't a missed opportunity. Like, it would have been, like, a lot of money. And I would have been like, I just wasted my time going through that box not knowing what the price was.
All right. I took the mic for long enough to ram that down your throat. What else have you been reading?
I guess I should do, we don't want to end we want to end on the best note possible. So I'll leave the Dark Hawk for the last, and I'll ask you, what is going on with Nick Spencer's Spider-Man run?
Yeah, I think it's very peak and valley-ish, isn't it? Where it's like...
Extremely. That's why I'm baffled when people say the run is fine. Like, I don't know how you could read that run and have no reaction to that run. Like, it is... Sometimes it is pretty great, and other times it is incomprehensible and pretty terrible.
Even when it's not great, there's still times where, like, things are coming together and you know they're at least, like, doing something. And then they... Yeah, to me, it's almost like listening to classical music in the background while you're doing something, and you could just be doing something and you don't even realize you're listening to it, and then every once in a while, like, it, like, picks up some tempo or intensity, and, like, it catches your ear, and that's, like, all you're doing is paying attention to it for a little bit, and then it sort of slowly fades back away into the ether.
Yeah, and then I'm like, so maybe they want him to have these punch out, like, semi events, or I'm not sure if that's him, or like, whenever the superior foes show up, I am immensely entertained. Like, that's one thing that I already knew he could do, and when he does that, I'm like, it's immensely entertaining for me. Like, I don't, it's so weird. And then the whole Kindred thing, I'm like, this is some good bits, but once they revealed who that was, I, like, my enthusiasm for, like, that character just went off a cliff.
And now that he's, like, frozen in carbonite, like Han Solo standing there, it's even worse, and everyone stands around him, like, talking to him. It's not. That's, comics are too expensive. You know?
I mean, that little, and then I was like, oh, the Sin Eater thing, there's gotta be a reason, there's a thing. I know sometimes you were waiting for a payoff in books, and I felt like I didn't got the payoff, and you didn't get the payoff. Now I feel like I'm in that situation with when the Sin Eater thing was going, because I'm like, oh, it's gonna do something. I'm like, nothing, and like, really nothing. And then the Kindred, I'm like, in that 6-issue thing they had going on there, I was just like, this is some of the worst stuff of the entire run.
And I don't mind when a story arc ends, like, in an annual. Say, right? Because it's like, oh, yeah. Now they're really going to let this thing breathe, right? And, like, tell the, you know, even like the old, even the Judas contract from the old Wolfman Perez Teen Titans, you know, it ended in the annual, so it could be the big final chapter and really make you feel like you read an epic kind of thing. But what's with the ending, like, in these, they can't keep it in title? Like, the end of the story has to be, like, in a giant size one shot? It's weird.
Yeah. I feel like that's kind of been their thing. So
they didn't have a point one? They didn't have, I mean, like, I don't know.
Please, it's gonna be easier to keep track of those one shots than any point ones.
Personally, I'd rather just have a double size issue that's of the regular numbering myself.
Yeah. Or if you're putting out 2 issues a month, I mean, like, you're already, I don't know. Maybe they have information about this. Does someone try out those Alpha Omegas and all that stuff? Like, they're like, oh, this is the perfect entry point. I'm like, maybe. Yeah, or I only read the events. I don't know. I'm just confused. I just don't know what is happening. Anyhow,
so Dark Hawk,
Yeah. So, if you assume this might not be true, if Rich Rider is the one true Nova, is he, Steve? Oh. I mean, there's a whole core.
Yeah. But true, you said.
Chris Powell the one true Darkhawk?
Absolutely.
Okay. So they had that whole Heart of the Hawk thing. That was it's fine for me to just spoil one of those little stories, right?
Yes,
like
please.
The one that's coming up. No. What you just kill him off in his anniversary issue? Yeah. And then the amulet's going to go to someone else?
Very Green Lantern, huh?
Like, what? I know, like...
I thought that was Nova. I thought Nova was the spacefaring hero who had the little brother who got corrupted years later. And, you know what I mean?
It's...
And got enlisted.
It's a little strange. And... Same writer, Kyle Higgins, as Radiant Black... Isn't that scene a little similar? Like, it's not...
Very.
Totally divergent from...
And not only that, but it seems like the early issues of Darkhawk is what that book seems like. You know? You become armored, you're trying to figure out... You're trying to figure out what's what. You're trying to figure out, is it still me inside this armor? Or is it my consciousness inside some kind of armored being? And if so, where's my... You know, that whole... That's fun.
You know, I loved the bit where he would take off his helmet and then he would be like, oh, no, I can't look at myself. Put the helmet back on. Like, I was all over that. Like, I don't. And once you find out what it was, I'm like, I was totally fine with that. Like, it wasn't a letdown or anything. I don't know. It's just so weird. I hear that Radiant Black goes through a twist, though, and I haven't read that, so I don't know. If I hope it doesn't take, like, X number of issues to get Darkhawk primed, because it promises not the end, so we're getting a miniseries. So hopefully that's on an accelerated pace.
I like the idea of doing something more with Darkhawk, but not totally ignoring the fact that stuff has been done with Darkhawk. And I thought that was cool about that anniversary issue, because it gave us, like, the Darkhawk that we remembered from the 90s, and then it gave us the Darkhawk that we just experienced with the Abnett and Lanning, etc. stuff. And now, going forward with that behind him, let's see what they do.
Yeah, like, I never need to see the Raptors again.
You're gonna. It's Darkhawk.
I mean, like, yeah, you can name check it and everything and, like, do your continuity thing. He seemed to show up and everyone had, like, a different take on him. Like when did he come back? Is that the early 2000s where he was with that team of not teen heroes, were they past teen now? But he was, like, the angry one.
I don't know. You read those teen books. Those teen group books.
I think it was a C.B. Cebulski book, too. and then he came back, and then he was, like, he was at Project Pegasus. Love that concept. And then now it's, like, the Raptors thing. It's...
We need Project Pegasus to be, like, reestablished or something. Like, there, those couple of places that you could tell stories around the Marvel Universe that... Just, you know, like the Star Labs. Like, it just needs to be there, you know?
So if, like, a character is, like, missing something from their status quo, just put them at Project Pegasus. It's like being at a museum or something. Someone's going to rob it or whatever. Stories are there.
That was so cool, too, right? That was, like, the plot device of the Marvel 2-in-1 book for years, was that Ben Grimm, in his off time from the FF, was the security chief at Project Pegasus, and that allowed him to run into all kinds of heroes in need or villains trying to do something with Project Pegasus or things that they're investigating or whatever. It was a great plot device. And then once that ended, it's like, now we've established that we have, like, a superpower being part of the security team at Project Pegasus, then there was always another one, right? It was like Quasar for a while and, you know, probably the Aquarian or something.
So the design, because, you know, Darkhawk, he needs to have all these... Like, the first one is so simplistic, but kind of great. And then they just keep on adding or modernizing, like, with all these extra doodads and all that type of thing. So L'Raz from, I guess people would say X-Men fame?
Yeah,
I would apparently, say. Apparently, has redesigned the Darkhawk, but I'm not sure if everyone's going to be able to pull it off. So we'll see. Hopeful.
All right, what we've got here is our fourth installment covering the late 70s Nova series, which we covered parts 1 through 3 on Marvel Noise episodes 347, 349, and 354. And now we are up to the finale of his series, which is Nova issues 22 to 25. That ran from the fall of 1978 through the spring of 1979. It was a bi-monthly book, so it took 8 months for those four issues to come out.
Ooh.
And it was interesting because it ran concurrently with some issues of Marv Wolfman's Fantastic Four run. That was a monthly book, and as this title ended, the story shifted over into FF, where we will pick it up there on the next episode. But first, there's a quick little interlude I've got to mention to you guys, because Nova had an appearance in Marvel 2-in-1 Annual 3, which was the 76 annual, written by Marv Wolfman, so, you know, it's legit. Art by Sal Buscema. And Nova and the Thing are dealing with the threat of these giant invaders, the Monitors.
And they need an anti-Monitor.
I'm thinking, where have I heard this before, right? And amazingly, there's also a Amazonian-type blonde in armor that's surprisingly similar-looking to the Harbinger character, who's involved too, who thwarts the Monitors along with Nova and the Thing. And it's just funny how this stuff keeps getting recycled and comes around, isn't it?
Yeah, pretty valiant.
Hey, Steve, if it's a good idea, it seems a shame to just do it once.
Jim Shooter's like, I like that name.
Wasn't that what her name was? The armored chick?
You who, are, yeah, yeah. That was her
who
name.
Who was like the Herald?
I can confirm they are very the armor one's like has reddish highlights, the other has purple, like very very similar with the blonde hair and all. I mean, not exactly, but you're right, it was kind of creepy when you look at the two next to them. You're like, wow, that's something.
So issue 22 of Nova is covered with a really nice Dave Cockrum, Joe Rubenstein cover that depicts the comet in kind of a cool pose.
Well, I have so many comments and questions about the comet.
Well, Steve, have you given the creative team yet? Because I have some comments.
It is Marv Wolfman and Carmine Infantino with inks this issue by Steve Lealoha, which is cool.
Long-time Noise fans will know that I'm a big Carmine Infantino from my youth, but doing some unrelated research into the comic book history, what I didn't realize is in the early 60s, Infantino was the penciler. Like, yep. He won a whole bunch of fanzine awards and everything.
He's good.
And I think it's really awesome that they let him bring the Flash back to Marvel, one of his famous characters. I mean, has any other character had those weird antenna earplug things other than the Flash?
Right.
Like, that was other than the color scheme, that was like, I love that thing too. Like, it looks cool and sci-fi, but man, Infantino a decade later bringing back, still bringing the magic.
Or is it Adam Strange? It's like a mix between the two, you know? That was, Infantino was also well known for his Adam Strange and Batman. He drew all the biggies.
Yeah, but the faces are what bring me back. And then when we get later on, I'll comment about some other tie-ins come to mind.
This is an interesting time for Infantino, though, because this is post him being the director, art director, and editor-in-chief, right, at DC for a while there?
I know Art, head of the art, I don't remember if he was EIC or not, but definitely the man.
I thought he was running things. But anyway, after that, he did freelance stuff for both DC, where he was doing, like, the Dial H for Heroes stuff, and then doing work for Marvel, too, where he did those Captain Universe stories in Marvel Spotlight, and he did a few issues of What If and this series and Star Wars.
That's
cool.
The one for me with Star Wars. And when we get to back into space, his tech is forever linked in my, he's lifting right off some of his Star Wars designs and everything, which is totally awesome. It puts Nova in the Star Wars universe, Steve.
Issue 22 opens with Diamond Head, a name longtime Nova Files will remember, assembling some thugs to help him take down Nova. He, like, interrupts their caper and then forcibly recruits them to his cause. Meanwhile, Rich Rider is out having dinner with his family, his folks, his brother Robbie, who we know in current continuity is getting all messed up, and they've got that stupid but surprisingly sophisticated robot Sherlock.
Well, one of those smart, supposedly. I mean, they better get the family stuff in, because they sort of fade into the background.
Yeah, well, if you go out into outer space, that'll happen. But what's cool is that they've finally, you know, they've come full circle with the story with them, though, because they know he's Nova now and are supporting him. And he, you know, he's taking them on little joy rides to show them what it's like to fly. It's cute. Then in a, quote, large New York City hospital, the derelict bum fellow that Rich's friend Mike Burley found and brought to the ER is like, he's like lighting up with this pink energy and flies out of the hospital on a pink lightning bolt. He's like, oh, why must the comet live again? And Mike runs after him. I think it's kind of cool, though, that his flight is depicted, you know, like Nova without seeing the legs, where it's just like a torso with energy shooting out the back.
So also, when you read all those history of the Marvel universes over the years and all those type of historical things, they mentioned one of the biggest heroes of all time, the Comet, right?
I'm afraid not, because even though he's revealing to Mike Burley that he's the missing legendary hero from the 50s, the Comet, he's actually making his first appearance here.
It's weird. Yeah. The book is like getting towards the end, and they're like, no, let's bring in some new characters, and let's bring back some favorites that we introduced, and let's try to spin these guys off.
Well, I don't like that Marvel, like with Flash Thompson, wants to rehabilitate all the bullies, like setting up unrealistic expectations. It's okay to let some of these guys that hassle our protagonists continue to be jerks. Like, I'm fine with that.
The Comet tells Mike that he was hit by a pink comet and it gave him powers and he fought crime and everything, but he doesn't want to talk about why he quit. He can't go there. So Diamond Head uses his new goons as a distraction and basically bait to snare Nova. Nova beats him up pretty good with his normal overuse of force. And then Diamond Head shows up and brings a building wall down on Nova. He's buried. Then the cops show up and they get thrown around like crazily thrown around. That Infantino. Phew! That's like somewhere between a bowling throw and an underhand pitch where he's just chucking this cop head first like a missile. It's pretty impressive.
Kind of reminds me when Nova gets punched. It always looks like his back is about to snap in half and then snap back.
Nova unburies himself from the rubble and everything, but Diamond Head really lets him have it. At one point, double-fisted right in the groin, Andrew.
Yeah, what is up with that? And then he punches him like in response. It's like literally like he does the same thing back to Diamond Head.
The double, as I, you know, I've gone
that's,
on.
That's why record. I mentioned you.
The double fist is the goofiest, losing all energy and power. But I guess there, it's more for the wrestling fans at home.
Well, look at this move because he's using it coming in from the side like a golf swing, so he can really get him right in the jewels. Then he punches him, kicks him, electrocutes him, and throws a car on him, burying him again under debris.
I do like how, I like to picture this, where after he kicks him over, he has time to like reach in the ground and grab the electric, like to really milk it, like an old-timey wrestling match, where he's really going to let him have it.
But guys, Diamond Head hasn't had it easy, though. I mean, after the Sphinx sent him flying in their last encounter, it embedded him into the side of a cliff face where he was just stuck there until, by chance, a group of army engineers was doing blasting nearby and blew him free, like violently blew him free with explosives. He flees the scene here just as the police are gathering and the comet shows up and frees Nova from the trunk of an old Impala or whatever it is here. Then, before flying off with the comet, and I think it kind of looks cool with them both flying together. It has like a real Human Torch and Toro vibe to it with them both flying there, leaving trails behind them, I think. Nova tells Mike Burley that the robbery charges and everything were dropped and he doesn't have to be on the lam anymore and can go back to being Mike Burley.
You mean I've been running for nothing all this time?
Well, no, at first you were running for your life, but not anymore.
He should have stood in a sidewalk in front of a bunch of TVs to find that information out, Steve.
Definitely, or the newspaper stand. So now we get the mystery voice behind the mechanical hand that acted to save Nova during that whole yellow claw thing, which was issue 16 that we covered the last time we did Nova on episode 354. He's heard commenting on Nova and the comet teaming up. I mean, he's been watching everything, and he's behind the Diamond Head's activities and stuff. He wants Diamond Head to bring Nova to him, but Diamond Head kind of just wants Nova dead.
And that totally looks like one of the robots from the Star Wars gambling facility that he drew. And I like it. I'm like, oh yeah, we're going to get his circuitry, his blaster design, his spaceship work. I had no idea who it was, by the way, in the real world when I was reading this. Like, I did not know from that hand alone.
Issue 20...
He's a true believer. It's who you think it is.
Issue 23 has a Infantino Bob McLeod cover. And it's Nova versus Diamond Head with, like, the comet flying onto the scene, all watched on a monitor by one of my favorite floating brains. It's Dr. Sun. From Wolfman's Tomb of Dracula series that...
Yes, the father of Basil Kronos.
That Jerry McDade and I covered some time ago, and with some help from you, too. You stood in on a Tomb of Dracula segment one year. And one of the reasons it's been so long since we've done this Nova segment, after doing the first three all kind of close together, was that Jerry McDade was saying, hey, like, remember back on the old... you know, boards, I was Rich Ryder as Nova was my handle. I really like the old Nova stuff. And I said, well, all right, we got to have Jerry come on and join us for the last. And then he was like busy and busy and busy. And I kept delaying and delaying to try to get it till he could be here. But we managed to get him on the segment anyway, just by mentioning him, right?
Shout out to McDade.
This issue is written by Wolfman with art by Infantino and many hands doing the inking. Mm-hmm. And it's Klaus Janson, Terry Austin, Bob Wycheck, Joe Rubinstein, Bob McLeod, Tom Palmer, and two pages, not consecutive, inked by Walt Simonson.
I mean, I always like when M. Hand shows up. Seems like they only use them for these rush jobs. They only had 2 months to do this issue, Steve, so you can clearly tell. You need to get in an expert like M. Hands to, you know, assign out the work or whatever.
Dr. Sun has been watching for months. He's after access to the orbiting Nova Prime spacecraft.
Can I just say, on a high note, this Dr. Sun is great. Like, yeah. Okay, maybe you want a bigger dome for the helmet, but I love the reinforced knees and elbows because it gives you the, like, the super skinny arms and legs kind of that look kind of... I love that kind of proportion of extreme things and, with like the bigger hand, like the hands that don't even look like they'd fit on it. Like just killer robot.
Doesn't like the curve of the wide pelvis piece make it sort of look like it's like a robot made? A little bit, like it's got that little bit of a, occasionally has a little bit of a suggesting the robot skirt.
Yeah.
I feel like I need a sketch of Dr. Sun. I'm like, it's going to be my like favorite obscure go-to. And then people will be like, who? And I'll be like, how come no one's, like, it seems like he would have become like a cult favorite at some point. And then, you know, he'll be like a Groot or whatever. Nope, no one cares about Dr. Sun.
His story's not done yet.
You'll need to bring a reference for that one, Kevin.
Yeah, I think so. They'll be who? What publisher?
And you know what? He's the one who made Robbie's robot so smart. So that finally makes sense why that Sherlock thing actually works.
It was him all along.
Yep. Nova and the Comet confront Diamond Head. And Diamond Head pummels Nova into the ground like Looney Tunes style. It's like he's a big peg being hammered in. And then he pounds him even deeper with a tree trunk and then buries him a third time under rubble. That's like his go-to move.
You gotta like it when you never are able to beat up your villain. Like, it is a nice twist. Like, he has no ability to defeat this guy, and it's kind of funny.
Well, the Comet tries to fight him with his, like, one finger. But it's no use, and he gets chucked, like, right off the page. Then Dr. Sun commandeers a bulldozer to free Nova from the rubble. Won't hurt a bit, right? And collect him.
And he straps him to a Star Wars table. I've always loved the panel trick of the different colors to give depth. They like this with the tech, too.
Yep.
So each one has a slightly different hue to give it like this 3D effect that I'm a big fan of. And I, like I said, parts of it is that tech Star Wars thing. But I just think it works really well in comics and is fun. And look at all that detail he puts in these machines. Like, that looks like a pain in the butt, if you want my opinion.
Back at the Ryder household, Sherlock the Bot, now that he's been revealed to be an agent of Dr. Sun, does this creepy thing with a rubber mask, like impersonating Rich to his friends at the door.
What is with that?
Almost pointless, right?
Hey, they fell for
like
it.
This Santa costume, almost.
Then Mike Burley goes rushing past them because he's in a hurry. He's headed to meet the Comet, who's still on the scene of their battle, and he called Mike Burley? Like, on what phone? From what phone? Like, how...
They still had pay phones back in the 70s, Steve.
Well, where was Mike Burley to answer the phone? And how the Comet get whatever number he called? I mean, this isn't the age of cell phones, true believers.
I'm sure he left him his number. Like, this is the only guy the Comet knows in the modern times other than Nova.
They're
like,
best buds.
And how many times were you home to answer the phone? Jeez.
Well, what's Mike Burley got to do? He just got home because he thought he was on the lam for years. He's probably spending time talking to mom and petting the family dog and grateful to be home from living on the streets.
Trying to earn yourself another no prize. The comet explains to Mike that he had a family once, but one of his adversaries bombed his house and killed his wife and kids and put him in the hospital for months. And when he left the hospital, he climbed into a bottle, and that's where Mike found him.
So it does work. If you were wondering how to take out your superhero, you know, I know they're always worried that it'll just give your superhero more motivation, but to all supervillains out there, apparently it does work.
When Nova awakes, we get a big stop, and then two pages of Gene Colan Tom Palmer art, not pulled from Tomb of Dracula, like new art for this issue, that recaps the origin and the history of Dr. Sun, which was really fun and comic booky.
Yeah, it's pretty great.
He was the Chi-Com's leading experimental doctor, but they decided his research was taking too long, so they forced him to be the subject and have his brain removed, and they made his son do the surgery, which was a real stab in the brain. And then they take his brain out and they put it in stasis, and then they have to keep that brain alive with new blood injections that give it that whole vampiric flavor that was worthy of him being in Wolfman's Tomb of Dracula book and putting him at odds with Dracula himself. So Nova tries to fight Dr. Sun's mech body, but he can't make a scratch. Then Dr. Sun teleports them onto the orbiting Nova Prime spaceship.
It's around?
It's been invisible up there. Cloaked.
I was very happy we were going back to the spaceship.
Yeah, let's get this thing going. His plan is to use the technology of the Nova Prime computer that, if you remember, stores the knowledge of all of the past Nova Centurion Primes to keep his brain alive without the constant need for fresh blood. And then he can take over the world.
Of course.
Well, I was so glad he added that last part because I was kind of on his side up until then.
I mean, I know, that doesn't sound so bad.
And then I could take over. Oh, okay. Here we go. So he straps Nova to a table in a page that's inked by Walt Simonson, so the tech looks extra good, Andrew.
Just so much detail in the backgrounds that, you know, I know they had, I mean, I joked about the 2 months, but I can see it. It's not like there's not stuff on the page to show you they didn't bang this out in an afternoon. Like, that's a lot of, it's a lot of lines to put.
Do you see Simonson in the tech, though? It totally looks like the side of the X-Factor ship or something, you know? So he straps Nova to a table and begins to extract info until he gets interrupted by another presence on the ship. And it's the Sphinx.
That guy again?
And the Sphinx is all, Nova is mine, step aside.
And he has he has his wrists on his hips, which is a weird kind of way. You know, you think your fists on your hips, but no, they're his wrists. And the cod gem looks pretty big and buff. It's been working out.
Issue 24 has a cover by Infantino and I think Rubenstein? And it's a cover homage to X-Men 100 with the supporting cast of good guys facing off against the baddies.
Except, who are all these people?
Except Condor. There's no Condor, right? He's the only guy missing.
Well, there's some kind of guy that's wearing a yellow costume with like a brown hood. There's the Flash. Then there's two red guys with red fists and feet in astronauts costumes.
I guess they're supposed to be like thralls.
I guess so.
And this issue has art by Infantino with Mike Esposito inks. And here the
And the new champions are here too. And the World's War One prologue.
The Sphinx and Dr. Sun share their motives regarding the the Nova computer system. And Nova wakes up and he fights back, but he can't stop the Sphinx. He can't even stop the Sphinx from breaking the rhythm of his speech, for Pete's sake.
Well, if he couldn't stop Diamond Head, I don't see how Sphinx is going to be easier, you know.
So the Sphinx learns that what he needs, that knowledge that he was always trying to get out of Nova's head, but it would kill him trying to extract it before he could get the knowledge, so he was caught in a catch-22 there. He learns that what he needs could be on Nova's home planet. No, not Nova's home planet, Earth, but the Nova core home planet.
Finally.
So he's going to assemble a crew and take this ship to return it to its home. Ride it back home. So meanwhile, back on Earth, or at least in the sky above Earth, if you're being technical, Crime Buster is flying in his little pod ship.
And Andrew cheered.
But Crime Buster. You need
the Comet's first appearance.
He's
like, if you're gonna be doing the Crime Buster like series, like definitely the Comet's gonna show up in that series. So you need to lock that down.
Their story isn't over, boys and girls. But he's searching for the Comet. And when he finds him, he wants to, you know, test him by shooting him down.
Yeah, that's probably not the best idea.
The Comet evades him, but then he gets netted. And then the Comet breaks free and is about to totally lay waste to the Crime Buster when the Crime Buster's all like, hey, I just want to talk. No need to fight. Well, hey.
Steve, I think we know the Crime Buster would have won. Lay waste the Crime
Well, sure,
Buster.
He got to have his licks in, but then when it's Comet's turn. But then the Crime Buster reveals, who would have thought? He's the Comet's son. He was presumed dead, but he survived. He wandered for days, mindless and feverish after the explosion, much like Peggy Carter did at the end of World War II, and became his own man. Crime Buster.
Much like me if I skip a meal.
They rush off together to help Nova, who is running an errand for the Sphinx. He's off recruiting Powerhouse. Remember him? This is getting to be like a This Is Your Life for Nova.
You might remember me from... I was thinking The Simpsons.
You might remember me from such earlier issues as Issue 5.
Hey, and look, the kids were clamoring for Powerhouse. He was a fan favorite from day one with a boring backstory and no good costume.
Well, back up the truck. That boring backstory gets all fixed here because now he suddenly remembers everything, Andrew. His powers, his origin. He's actually from Xandar, Nova Centaurian home planet, and he knows how to fly the ship.
Wow, this just got way better.
Sometimes, Steve, the new writer has to clean up the old writer's mistakes.
It's all been Marv Wolfman all along. And he even puts in the, how did I not recognize that your costume is like the police force of my home planet's costume? God, why indeed? So the Comet and the Crime Buster arrive on scene just as Nova and Powerhouse are brought back to the ship by a tractor beam. So now the cast is complete, except for Condor. Oh, and there's a stowaway on Crime Buster's podcraft. It's Diamond Head. Uh-oh. And that leads us to the finale, issue 25, the last issue of Nova, the Human Rocket. And instead of "He's Here" above the title on the cover, it reads "He's Gone" on the cover. And it's a very different looking cover with a pin-up style image by Keith Pollard with inks by Rudy Nabriz.
Really put a lot of this could be a poster type, though, with all the fine, like, really fine figure work and energy put into it, I feel like.
This issue is written by Wolfman with art by Infantino and Klaus Janson.
This is the stuff.
As the cast travels aboard the Nova ship back to Xandar, the Sphinx relates the outcome of his last appearance, which was in the also Wolfman written Fantastic Four Annual 12 from 1976, I think. There the Sphinx had to deal with both the Fantastic Four and the Inhumans, and he dealt with them pretty well until Black Bolt got mad, and in the end, the Sphinx was left hurtling through space. But he eventually meditated and reached out and found and controlled Quasimodo, this mostly artificial computer being who, at the end of Fantastic Four issue 202, also written by Wolfman, was leaving Earth in one of the Fantastic Four's rockets and detected something that he couldn't see, that as he was flying by on the last page, discerned that it had to be an invisible ship of some kind in Earth's orbit.
Quasi.
So the Sphinx puts two and two together, realizing that Nova's got that ship, that, and Quasimodo discovered this location of this anomaly and uses Quasimodo's ship to get him there. And that's when he ran into Dr. Sun and Nova.
Did you know they've been aboard the ship for like 2 weeks? Like, and Nova goes into this whole thing about crying himself to sleep. And I'm like, every night. And I'm like, wait, how long have you been here? And I'm like, have they been eating, sleeping, and there's quarters? And
yeah, I mean, they do.
Yeah, because the Nova Prime guy, that was his home. So I presume he had all that. I mean, they'd have to eat food from a foreign planet, which might, you know, not sit well. But
I don't know. Maybe they're just getting paste out of some computer and it's just nutrients.
It also gives them time to have those, like, traveling, you know, while traveling moments. They can devote a page or two to Crime Buster and the Comet talking about being father and son and fighting together and all that stuff. And they can have this, like, because the Sphinx is kind of like we were talking about off the air prior to recording, was almost like a quasi-Thanos-type character, or attempting to be that way for Wolfman, where he's like more calculated and he's the villain and he's willing to beat everybody down on the ship, but he doesn't need to be fighting everyone and he can be just manipulating everyone and be the planner, and as long as everything is going towards his goal, and his goal is something big and something cosmic and something cryptic that he can't really say. And you know, the more
I think his goal is he wants to die, which links him, I guess, to Thanos in a way, whose obsession with death. So, yeah, I can see the connection that way. Because it's so funny, because he contrasts himself with Dr. Sun. He's like, dude, you don't want to live forever.
Yeah. Yeah, they so even give them that character moment together, right? Of comparing that, the pluses and minuses of immortality, where it's one guy's goal and it's the other guy's burden. You know, but I mean,
apparently they are traveling quickly through this negative space, better than the negative zone, but still it takes a long time.
When you talk about the Sphinx's master plan and his motives and stuff, just thinking back at, like, Wolfman wrote this whole series and edited it, and I really see the motivations change. I mean, you know, he changed Powerhouse's whole character at the end here, and there was, remember when Condor's, like, plans and motivations, like, changed on a dime? And this, I think there's a lot of stuff that he put into play and didn't have figured out at all. The Sphinx is certain that the computer banks on Xander still exist, so that's where they're headed. And, oh man, he crushes Dr. Sun's hand and tosses Nova into, like, almost a scorpion pose.
Crack. Dr. Sun cracks me up, though. He's when he's fighting the Sphinx, he's like, insufferable buffoon. I knew we would come to blows.
This can't be happening.
Well, yeah, like, you know? My arm, what did you do? Like, well, dude, you got in a fight. Like, he's going to attack you. But
Diamond Head then reveals himself, and the Sphinx just shatters him, but reassembles him.
Let that be a lesson.
Just then, their ship gets attacked by a Skrull fleet.
So they can detect them inside that space, or they went inside the And then they pop out the regular space?
Well, yeah, I guess they're getting close, right? They gotta be. It's the last issue of the series. They gotta be getting close.
I hope so.
The Sphinx, Nova, and the Comet, and Powerhouse all leave the ship and go fight. So, back on board, Diamond Head attacks Crime Buster, and it looks like he's gonna rock, paper, and scissors him to death. He's like, is he like, rock, 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 good old rock. But the Sphinx interrupts it. So, why are the Skrulls attacking? And when are we getting to Xander? Why is the Sphinx, like, destiny it back on this planet and everything? Like, that's the end of the issue and the series, and we don't have any answers to any of these things. But because Wolfman's the writer and editor, he says it's continued next episode in the pages of his other book, The Fantastic Four.
These Skrulls are pretty insulting, too. Like,
they sure
they're like, dung dog, the Earthling attacks, destroy the mudslime.
See, that's who I think those ridiculous things on the cover were supposed to be in the spacesuits fighting alongside the Sphinx.
Oh.
Yeah, and they can look like anything, so... You know,
but spoiler, that's the problem that's happening back on Nova Prime's home planet, back on Xander, is the Skrulls are invading. So that's why they've passed them here in space. And a couple of the issues of Fantastic Four that we're going to read and cover next time actually occur at the same time or slightly before these issues and set things up kind of what's happening there, and then we'll get these two storylines colliding and address things through the lens of the Fantastic Four, Marvel's first family. Enough said.
So, Steve, you're telling me the Skrulls are revolting?
They certainly are. But what a weird last issue of a series, right? I mean...
Yeah. And what a cliffhanger. Like, what if you're not going to get that Fantastic Four issue?
I do like that Wolfman really connected his books, though. Like, Dr. Sun alone was in the Dracula and Nova and Fantastic Four. That's pretty cool. And the Sphinx, too. Well, he wasn't in Dracula, but Nova and Fantastic Four both. So that's fun.
Well, one thing I can say about these issues... These were not the worst issues of Nova. I mean, yeah. Probably some of my more favorite issues of Nova.
But they're setup issues to, like, build towards a big issue 25 that doesn't happen.
Yeah.
You know, it's still more setup, so there's more coming, and the story is grand, and it's a lot of fun, and it's stuff that, like, you know, I was 8 and 9 years old when I was reading these stories off the racks and really enjoyed, and then it goes on for, like, another year in FF. And then, spoiler, then it goes over later in ROM for a few issues and totally wraps the story up, the dangling plot lines. I mean, this was a grand sweeping thing that was happening in my Marvel comics, and it didn't matter which one I was reading. it was back there happening for, you know, more than a year, and that's fun.
So a double-sized issue wouldn't have helped Nova 25. Still too much story.
Yeah, because, too much to come. But we'll get there, and I'm so psyched for you guys to join me in reading these, because I've been wanting to reread Wolfman's Fantastic Four ever since we were back doing the Fantastic Four sites bit. And that was next on the old stuff to read, but we didn't do it because we... bailed so hard on the Fraction FF.
You said it just went back.
I do like how it ends with the Sphinx doing his get smart moment of missed it by that much. It's a close-up of his face and his fingers are close together, and that's for people who don't know, an old TV show with a funny catchphrase, but he would repeat that, missed it by that much.
Chief?
As long as Sphinx doesn't bring down the cone of silence.
See? Kevin knows.
And these issues are on the Unlimited if people want to follow along at home.